Welcome to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. AmCham Business Podcasts are hosted by Dr. Duff Watkins. Duff is a director of ExecSearch International, an author, and is also on the AmCham Council of Governors. AmCham, bringing business to you.
Hello and welcome to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia, AmCham, bringing business to you. And in business we trust, today we're going to discuss how your trusted behaviors can win you more work, earn you more money, enhance your relationships, and improve your life. Our guest today is Keith Dugdale, who is an author, coach, and international speaker on building trust in business. In fact, his book is one of my favorites, Smarter Selling, How to Grow Sales by Building Trust. I'll just hold it up to the microphone so you listeners can see it. He is the co-developer of the Engage Training Program, which has been delivered to many thousands of people around the world, all about building trust. Today, you'll see why being a trustworthy business person is more important than ever, especially in sales. You'll hear why the most successful business people and companies drive trustworthy behavior, and you'll learn how the key to building trust really is just a few skills. Sounds simple. Let's find out. Now, Keith, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks, Duff. Thanks for having me.
You write books about trust. You lead seminars, workshops around the world on trust. Your company is called The Business of Trust. I'm gathering that you think trust is pretty important in business. And in fact, you're telling me that it's more crucial than it ever has been before.
Absolutely. I mean, it's driven me, it's driven the business for a dozen years. And I think what's happening out in the business community now is, you know, if you go back maybe 10 years, a lot of businesses said how critical client relationships were to them, customer relationships. But quite frankly, not many did a lot about it. We've seen the GFC in the Northern Hemisphere come through in 2007, 2008. We've seen the mines turn off the tap in Australia in 2012. And I think it's really reset the bar, if you like. And so what we're starting to see now are companies really understanding that whilst they might have been able to differentiate and get a really good price based on the quality of what they did before, that's now a given. Your customer probably knows more about you than you do. And so without trust, you've got nothing.
All right. Give me the punchline right up front. Well, we're talking about business people, but let's use salespeople as an example because they're the frontline people. What are the three things, or the key things, that a person needs to do now in order to be seen as more trustworthy?
Okay, three things, really quick, to the point. One, they need to give a damn about their client. They need to care about their customer. If they don't care, they can't fake it. And so we're seeing a lot of work in that area. Secondly, they need to actually have the skill and confidence to help their client. And the third thing is they need to understand what value is to their client, way beyond the thing they sell.
Okay. They need to care, they need to have the skill to help, and they need to understand what value is to the client. Okay, I got that. Okay, so what do companies do? What can organizations do to drive, inculcate this sort of behavior?
We probably need about 2 days to chat about that, Duff. Seriously, most organizations I know are driven by the technical expertise within the organization. So they develop functional lines of service or business or offerings, and then you get promoted within those and you get rewarded by the more you know about that product or service, etc. And what we're seeing now is some organizations, primarily in the Northern Hemisphere, although there are a couple here down in Australia and New Zealand, saying actually that model is fundamentally flawed. What we need to do is, and look at the Future Employment Report by Oxford University out of the UK that talks about 47% of jobs disappearing, and largely those are knowledge-based jobs, not just menial jobs. And what they're saying is there's only two things that you can differentiate on going forward. One is the relationships you have, and the second is your ability to innovate. And so what we're starting to see in organizations is changing the whole structure and ethos of the organization to be one that's driven around relationships and innovation. And once you've got your head around that and a leadership team focused around that, you can then bring through the structure, the rewards, the recruitment, everything that drives the behavior of building trust. Without all that other stuff in place, you'll get success, but not significant success.
In your book, or somewhere I've read, you talk about structure, people, and skills.
Yeah.
Sounds like a law firm, but it's really not. Structure, people, and skills. Well, what sort of examples can you give us?
Okay.
Who's doing it right?
So there's an organization I'm working with in Europe at the moment. For example, their leadership team used to be all the functional line leaders. As of around now, The three people who sit on the leadership team are the CEO, in effect, the head of innovation, and the head of client relationships. That's the structure. And then underneath that, everyone reports to them. And the reason for that is so the head of a certain line of business has to make sure that everything is validated by the relationship person and the innovation person. And so you end up with this totally different structure in the organization. So that's the structure side of things. The second side of things in terms of the people, we're seeing a complete shift finally in the criteria for recruiting people. Now this is going to sound fairly superficial, but we've now gone back to some things I saw in the UK in the 1980s, where law firms are actively not recruiting the smartest lawyer, because the smartest lawyer is not necessarily going to be the one who can build trust. And also they tend to leave pretty quickly. So now the criteria, and there's an engineering firm in Melbourne who do this very actively, they only recruit engineers from university who have worked in a customer interface job all the way through university. So that by the time they come in as an engineer, they also have the ability to communicate. Sounds simple, but actually there aren't that many, sadly. So that's kind of the structure and the people side. And the skill side is hard, because if you've been doing something a certain way for so many years, and you are by definition successful, any change can be seen as a risk, because I got to where I am by doing what I do. Therefore, you're telling me to change what I do, that could be risky. And so, for example, if I've got an engineer, say, who's been a consulting engineer for 20 years, expert in pumps and pipes, they're a water engineer, they really know their field. And I'm suddenly saying, actually, that knowledge is a given. What you need to do now is to be able to ask questions which help you understand where the customer's strategy is, so that then you can bring value to help them in their strategy, notwithstanding that that might have nothing to do with your product. That's a very scary place for that person to go. And then that loops back to the structure, because then you have to have reward mechanisms that drive that behavior and don't drive filling in the pipeline with numbers. So there's big changes, and some firms are getting it absolutely right.
Well, and so one of the criteria, it sounds like, is that there is an emphasis on greater emotional intelligence, EQ as it's called, rather than straightforward IQ, although there's nothing wrong with having a high IQ. We should point that out.
No, absolutely right. I'd rather, let's not go there. But absolutely, the EQ, and everyone's talked about this for years and years and years. IQ you can measure. You know, when you're 3 years old at school, through, you know, junior school, secondary school, university, through your promotion at work, you can measure IQ by a test. EQ is really hard to measure. And therefore, people don't try, and therefore they end up rewarding the thing they can measure, which is IQ. And so you do end up with people in organizations of all walks of life, very top of organizations, theoretically responsible for a customer relationship, who frankly should be locked in a dark room. And everyone knows they should be.
Yeah.
But they're at this they have this position in the organization. And so what we've seen probably over the last 2 years in this part of the world, and I think it's been going on longer in the Northern Hemisphere, is organizations actually I had a conversation on this yesterday. It's absolutely relevant. In a partnership, if I go back 5 years in a partnership, accounting partnership, if you were technically brilliant, you could make partner. If you were not technically brilliant, but you were good with clients, you never made partner. You went down a parallel path to what they call principal. As of this year, the firm I was talking to have actually flipped that 180 degrees. If you are just technically very good but can't hold a conversation, you now make principal. If you can hold a conversation, your technical ability is secondary, you will make partner. That's a massive shift. So some firms are getting it right, but sadly, a lot of organizations are still saying, we know we need to change, maybe next year.
You know, I can corroborate this. I run an executive search firm and I've used psychometrics for years. I can easily measure IQ. I used to. I don't anymore because it's not that important. What I do measure is personality, and you can actually predict people's performance, emotional, and I would say that you can measure it. You can predict performance based on their interpersonal skills.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I agree, you can measure it. But the thing is, the people who live at the top of these organizations are themselves analysts. And so they don't believe an EQ measure. We use a behavioral tool, and one of the behaviors you look at on that is, we call it opportunity and fear. So basically, to what extent are you risk averse? We're working with one organization at the moment. The average across the entire organization is 58 out of 180. And that means there is no one in the whole organization who is at all opportunistic, who believes in having a go, let's try. Everyone in the business is fixated on being risk averse. That's never going to take you to the next level, because someone in the room will always say, but. And so you never move there. So what we're starting to see is certain industries bring in, and it's very brave, bringing in CEOs from very different industries to change their world. Those are the ones who will succeed. Even if the new CEO comes in and gets some things wrong, they will at least change their world. Those who try and just do everything from within, I really do wish them good luck. Mm. Occasionally you'll find a great person, but if they've come up through that ecosystem for 20 years, they're unlikely to really shake things up.
Okay, you're working with organizations around the world. Do you have, and you're indicating that it's the change, the positive change starts at the top. Do you have any before and after pictures you can show us? Any illustrations, examples?
Absolutely. So obviously I'm not going to mention the organization or even where it's based because that's probably
given. Come on, give us some gossip.
I'll get it.
Give us some dirt.
I don't think the gentleman involved will be too actually, he might be, you never know, but I'm not going to go there. Anyway, so this is a fairly typical story. An organization been around forever. It's not global, but it operates across the Southern Hemisphere. Very large organization, very successful, had a really tough time over the last few years because of what's happened in this part of the world, or around the world, I guess, in mining. So they bring in a new leader. And so that was kind of the before. And what he had to do several things. Firstly was he had to make sure, to steal a Jim Collins line, that he had the right people on the bus. He had to get the right leaders in the business and get rid of those who did not want to change. Because without that, you're never going to change. And that's a painful process, especially here in Australia. So that was one thing he did. The second thing he did was cut the tail. So looked at the clients they had, the customers they had, and cut the customer base from just under 500 to 200 in about 18 months. Because one of the things that happens is, in good times, we lose all the discipline around the kind of clients we want to have because we don't have a strategy. We just grab any piece of work that comes through the door. So cut that tail by more than 50%. And the third thing was we worked with them on shifting their paradigm from we're about winning work to we're about building our relationship capital. And so we worked them on that with their key accounts, on making sure they identified who are the critical people to have relationships with, put the right people on those clients, made sure they had the right relationships. We skilled them up to have those relationships. And the boss would say the main thing that we actually gave them, as well as the skills, was actually the empowerment to go and do it, rather than the fear of doing it. So that's what happened. And the end game was they actually increased their profitability by 40% in 12 months. That's a pretty good outcome.
A measurable, tangible result.
Absolutely measurable, tangible. Can you point to which bit of what they did led to 40%? No.
It was the constellation of change.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. That's a nice way of putting it.
And we'll be right back.
Connectivity in our rapidly changing business environment is crucial for success. AmCham events are the forum to find potential clients and business partners and are filled with opportunities to showcase your organization. Visit amcham.com.au for more information about how you can start benefiting.
And we're back. Keith, what do listeners need to do to make sure that they can embed some of these skills either in themselves or in their companies?
If I address both of those separately, and if I probably do the company first, I think if you're going to embed the whole philosophy, it's a culture change project. It's an entirely culture change project. And you talked about the fact I'm heading to Europe this weekend. And what we're trying to do in those kinds of situations is get an organization not to jump forward too fast and take it as a simple thing. I want them to take a step back and get the leaders in a room and really understand what do we want to look like as an organization 3 years from now, and then let's actually see what we need to break apart. And that's a big piece of work. And then you move through making sure you've got strategy, you've got the support mechanisms in place, because that's critical again, because if you're going to change behavior, you need to have support mechanisms, whether it's coaching, whether it's online, whether it's intranet support, whatever it is, it needs to be there for any change.
It's a suite of things.
It's a whole suite of things.
It's not a one-shot deal.
Absolutely.
No magic bullet. Bummer.
There isn't a magic. And actually, I had that conversation with someone the other day, actually, in Houston. Mm-hmm. Rang me and said, what's the magic bullet? And we had a one-hour conversation. At the end, he said, so there isn't one. I said, no.
But that won't stop us from looking.
We want a quick fix, please. But unless you've got the strategy right, and unless you've got the ongoing support right, it doesn't matter what you do with the people. They're not going to change because it's not safe and I'm not empowered and I've not got the ongoing support. So that's kind of at a corporate level. And it's at an individual level, if you work within a corporate or whether you work on your own in a small entity, it's down to your self-belief. If you know that the behaviors that we're advocating are right, you believe they're right and you have the skill and confidence to do it, what I would say is just do it and hang the internal consequences. And we've got some amazing stories of people within corporates just bucking the rules because they know it's right. And suddenly, strangely, they become the stars. And we've also seen some very small entities I'll just leapfrog competition by suddenly saying, let's do this, because it works. So it's for the individual, I think it's develop the belief and have the confidence to do it. And for the organization, there's a whole bunch of stuff. We talk about seven pillars of change within that kind of thing, but it's a big task.
Now, mate, you keep picking on Australia, saying how conservative we are and how resistant to change. Now, I know you're a worldly guy. Seriously, what lessons from abroad have you observed, say, well, anywhere outside of Australia, that we need to learn here?
I think, you know, one of the key lessons is, and I think the frustrations for me around when I talk about Australia being relatively conservative, is the global financial crisis had a more profound impact on organisations around the world than anything in my lifetime. And you don't have to look very deep to see what certain organisations did do and certain organisations didn't do, primarily in Europe and the States, but also in Asia, to flip the trend. When the mines turned the taps off here in October 2012, if a lot of organizations had just said, okay, actually you could see it coming, but most didn't, but okay, let's go and look at what unsuccessful businesses did in the Northern Hemisphere and what successful businesses did, it would be very clear some of the things they should and shouldn't do. Instead, what I saw happen in most organizations here was kind of the, it'll come back. Mm-hmm. It was like the five stages of grieving when mm-hmm. someone dies, mm-hmm. yeah? Denial, it'll yes. come back, it'll come back, it'll come back. Rather than say, uh-oh, there might be something going on here, and go and look. And there are some really good lessons from organisations there. So if I pick, you know, the typical response of it in any organisation when there's a downturn is blame the economy and then cut costs to maintain margins. So you strip out all your HR functions, all the back office costs, and everyone's happy because the profits are okay, even though our revenue's down. Mm-hmm. Some firms did that in the Northern Hemisphere, but some I know, between 2008 and 2012, managed to drop 40% per hour worked. So for every hour they worked, they earned 40% less by stripping the costs. And then they got to a point where there's no more costs to strip.
Yes.
And they realized, actually, this is not coming back. Mm-hmm. We need to change. So those are the firms they should learn from and say, we shouldn't do that. And yet most organizations I know here are doing exactly that. It'll come back, it'll come back. Let's strip the costs out. Let's offload the marketing function, etc. I think that there was a tide shift in Australia somewhere in the middle of 2015, where I think a lot of firms started to realize, actually, this isn't coming back. These mines, yes, things might get better and the oil price might go up and, you know, the government here might start investing a bit more in infrastructure, but we're in a new world. And so what we need to do is fundamentally change. And I saw this a huge shift in the acknowledgement of a need for change somewhere in the second half of 2015.
Let me get your reaction to a couple of things. You're saying that being an expert is a given. Everyone's an expert now, so it's not about your expertise, it's about your ability to establish intimacy. That's a key differentiator.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it doesn't matter what if I'm a customer organization, a client organization, it doesn't matter if I'm trying to buy a widget, a car, a house, legal advice, accounting advice, it doesn't matter what I'm trying to buy. I can get so much information for free now. And so what happens is if you are a supplier to me and all you're giving me is information about your product, then I'm getting no value from that other than the product. So what I as a customer will go to is price, and the price drops down. And you can look at countless firms in the UK, for example, Woolworths, you can just list them off, mm-hmm. who kept on going down that price efficiency route. And then you run out of room to maneuver. You can still sell the same product, but what you need to do is to have this trust, the intimacy, with someone in an organization who buys what it is you've got, so that when they're working with you, they understand that you genuinely care about their own personal success and the corporate success. You know, there's a really nice, simple equation by the guru in professional services, at least in trust, David Maister, who wrote The Trusted Advisor years ago. And his equation, I think, still stands absolutely right. And he says that your trustworthiness, i.e. the extent to which anybody should trust you, is a function of your credibility, do you know your stuff, plus your reliability, do you do what you say mm-hmm. you're going to do, mm-hmm. plus your intimacy, to steal your word, and that's the extent to which you come across as showing you genuinely care about their success. And then divide it all by self-orientation, which is, are you only there when you think there's something to sell, and do you talk a lot about your product and your service and yourself? And when you look at that, the intimacy is the place to go, because credibility, that's given. Reliability, well, if you're not reliable, you might get a one hit, but mm-hmm. that's it. So get away from the self-orientation and build the intimacy. But it's hard.
Okay, so in order to be trustworthy, I have to demonstrate value to the customer, to the client, but it has to be value that they perceive as value, not as what I perceive
Absolutely.
As value.
Absolutely.
Because I've learned the hard way that what I think is valuable is highly discounted by the customer. So I've had to change significantly. Okay, so how do I do that? How do I find out what the customer really, truly values?
Okay, so there's probably two stages to this. If you have a relationship and you can have dialogue with the customer, it's actually about having a conversation. So again, Nick, Stephen, Covey, seek first to understand and then be understood. But it's a different type of question. So the typical question that any provider would ask of a customer is, so how's business and what are your challenges? But that's really narrow and short term, and probably the challenges will relate back to the salesperson's product. If instead you can get into the position of asking questions which are along the lines of, okay, so where do you see the business being in 3 years? Where do you see your career being in 3 years? Where do you see your function being in 3 years? Two things, or several things happen. First is you show that you actually care about the future success of the person, regardless of what you're doing. You also give them the sense that you care, which makes a big difference. And then the next trick in there is that you then bring to the table for them ideas, insights, contacts, confidence in the things that they need to do to get to where they're trying to get to, regardless of whether it has anything to do with your product or service. That's how you build what we call that total trusted partner relationship. You're not just there to flog your thing. That's when you can have the conversation. If you're trying to build a relationship from cold with someone like that, you know, we all get 1,000 spam emails a day and we know what we do with them. And yet most organizations, as I do, then go and do that to the clients they want to have. Yeah. They can't put the shoe on the other foot.
Yeah.
What you need to do then is you need to do your research, but the research is typically not to do the research about the client you want to meet, because you'll never know more about your client than they do. It's to get your head into their world. Think about the person you want to meet. Think about the job they have. Think about the organization they work for. Think about the industry they work in. And then figure out what is probably center of their universe. You know, maybe do a pest analysis, for example. You know, look at the political, economic, social, and technological things that might be going on for Duff, if I wanted to meet Duff. And then I have to construct an invitation, whether it's by phone or email, that makes it very clear to Duff that I want to meet him because I want to understand his world. I've done a bit of work and looking at the world as I suspect it is, and I'm going to go and do some lateral research to bring Duff ideas that might be helpful. So for as a simple example, so Duff, as you said, you run an exec.
Executive search firm. Yes.
So if I wanted to meet you from the outset, what I might do is go and do some research into what exec research firms have been doing in Europe over the last couple of years, who've managed to really have exponential growth. It's got nothing to do with my service, but if I can bring you some ideas and maybe some papers that you might not be aware of, that's huge value to you. It's got nothing to do with my product. So I build this trust beyond that. Yeah, and so things shift really quickly.
Well, you know, I have to corroborate that. So many emails I get in my role, people sending me unsolicited resumes, they want to call me up, take up time, and they offer absolutely nothing. And that kind of goes with the job, but, you know, I mean, I don't return those calls, those emails. I have no use for them. It just becomes an impediment. So you're right. They don't really think it through, and this happens. It's been happening for 25 years. I don't think the tide is going to turn.
No, but what has changed in 25 years is more people are sending them. So you're getting more spam. You're getting more rubbish.
Sure.
So what I would say is if I sent you an email and the subject line said something like, how exec search firms in the UK have grown by 300% in 12 months, you might at least press, I wonder what that is. And as long as then when you open it, there's something there that is of value, you might have the meeting. But if it's all high, I'm from a sales training company, I think you should really talk to me. Delete.
I like to think I kind of did that now that I think about it, Keith, when I sent you the invitation to do the podcast, trying to construct a value proposition that would have some benefit for you.
Absolutely.
Because you're donating your time to AmCham, and so AmCham's grateful for that.
No, but that's a critical point, is that you are donating your time. And as we work with customers, one of the other things we're saying is that they need to have this trusted relationship typically with someone higher up the food chain in the customer organization. The higher up you go up in a customer organization, the more time becomes valuable than money. And so, you know, I've spoken to or seen commentary by a couple of CFOs of global organizations in Europe saying, I will give my time to the people who give me most value for the time, not value for the money. And so the onus on the salesperson or anyone in business who wants to build a relationship is you have to give your client a huge return on investment for the time they are spending with you.
Mm-hmm. Not for the product or the project or the advice. That's a given. For every second they spend with you. Because if you are not giving your customer value, you are wasting their time.
Mm. What I'm inferring from your comments, Keith, is that the economic buyer, whether it's the procurement manager or the CEO, they're actually looking for a trustworthy person, not a product or expertise. They really don't care about the widgets because, as you say, the widgets are commonly available. They really are seeking somebody to put their trust into.
No, absolutely. There is a difference, though. So if you're dealing with the procurement manager, they may be the economic buyer, but they're most likely, and this is stealing Miller-Hyman language, they're more likely to be the technical buyer. You still need to build trust with the technical buyer. You still need to have that same relationship, otherwise you're like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And then you can justifiably go back to the business and say, we lost on price. Because mm-hmm. that's what the procurement person will tell you. No, all the research by firms such as Beaton's show you that it's not price, it's value for what you were doing. As you go up the ladder to the economic buyers, it has to be about trust. Because if I'm sitting talking to the chief operating officer in an organization about his business and his strategy, that's useful time for him. If I'm talking to him about sales training programs, he'll just say, oh, you need to talk to our HR function. Because he has no interest in talking about that.
Yeah.
So you have to change the game.
You talk, I think it's in your book, about the three strategies for success.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate?
This is actually a fairly well-used strategy thinking by Treacy and Viasema. And they say that in order to succeed as a business, you need to either be focused on efficiency, customer intimacy, or innovation. And you need to be the best in class at one of the three and as good as your competition in the other two. And this has been going on for years. What I think has changed is that if you focus on the efficiency side of peace, that can only go so far. And you hit a point where you can't be more efficient. You can't bring your cost base down. And that leaves you the two other places to run, which is where it corroborates totally with the recent research, which is then your choice is, do we become the most innovative or the one closest to our customer? And unless you're focusing on one or both of those, then there's trouble coming.
You talk also, or you write about, how people will be rewarded in the future and how it may be 180 degrees different than what we're currently used to.
Absolutely. So if you look at the typical salesperson, and we'll go to the sales line, salesperson remuneration is typically a base salary plus a bonus based on what they brought into the business. Okay, so you've seen some changes on that. You've seen it where some firms now give because of a fear of a single line of business sales and they're not doing enough cross-selling, they might give you double the bonus if you bring in work for another part of the business, so that kind of stuff. What we're starting to see, and actually I had two conversations yesterday with organizations wanting to go down this track, is where they are now focusing on rewarding salespeople on the relationship capital they bring to the business. And what I mean by that is saying, okay, so if we now know, and I'll go back to what we said earlier, we now know what our key account, key client strategy is, who the accounts are, and you, Duff, you're the salesperson, and you're responsible for these accounts. Yes, cash will be part of the reward in terms of, you know, what the revenues and the profits are from these clients, but an equal measure is how have you grown the relationship capital with those clients? Has your depth of relationship with each of the people you're supposed to have relationships with improved? You know, and you can score it, you can measure it. It's not as scientific as measuring 3.2%, but you can measure it, and you can measure the improvement. And so every month, or every 3 months, or every 6 months, or every year, Duff, your relationship capital has increased from X to Y. Here's your bonus. But that only works if you have a business and a structure that genuinely believes that relationship capital is king. And where I think it's going to end up, and there's certainly some evidence of this, is that when you then come to recruit these salespeople, part of the interview will be, well, what's your relationship capital in the market? So rather than who do you know, and everyone says, oh, I know everyone in town, I know all these people, yeah, show me the evidence. Show me what the relationships actually looks like with these people. Then I'll deem whether or not you're recruitable. Mm. And that's a very big shift from even where we are now.
Okay, we're talking stats and numbers. I know there's some skeptical listeners out there. Yeah. They'll be thinking, okay, yeah, Keith, heard it all before. Lovey-dovey, touchy-feely, new age kind of stuff. Give me some hard stats. Give me some numbers. Do you have any success stories about how your approach, your program, the training has had significant positive impact on the bottom line?
Certainly.
I know you got a million of them, so lay a few on us.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is you can never prove Yeah, so if a business has success, if it suddenly grows by X percent or X million dollars or whatever, you can never prove what actually caused it. As you said, it's kind of the constellation of things. But we have got enough situations of clients who've been prepared to put in writing that says that what our firm did, as part of a suite of things, has led to ridiculous growth. So what one firm in Australia pointed to it being somewhere between $1 and $200 million. That's a big gap, $1 and $200 million. But what they were saying was, we know it's at least $100 million because we can point to those contracts that mm-hmm. we would not mm-hmm. have won without. We think it's a lot more, but we don't know what it is. The upside of change, and I don't want it to be seen as me trying to spruik what we do, but the upside of change, if you get the change right, is phenomenal. And what I'd say to anyone who is skeptical out there in terms of the need to change is imagine your most direct competitor makes that fundamental change, whatever that is, tomorrow. And imagine that that competitor now is building the relationships that I talk about with the economic buyers in your clients. How does that make you feel? Because they are. And I can promise you they are trying to, because right now, I don't know what it's like, but I think probably every week I've probably got between 3 and 6 new organizations knocking on the door saying, help. So there are enough organizations that, I'm not saying all those are going to go and do it.
And those organizations are law firms, professional service firms, industrial, all
absolutely. I think the professional services firms are the ones who, ironically, have got the most salespeople per capita. But what we're starting to see now is that even in products, so there's one organization we work with in Australia who sell hardware. They sell hardware. And not surprisingly, diminishing returns over the years, big organization, diminishing returns over the years because they can go and get a Sanyo thing from 1,000 places. So what they've done is flip their model into being a professional services business that consults. So now what they do is they work with the heads of business around Australia on their strategy and then helps them understand what technologies are around to help empower their strategy. They charge for that consulting advice, but now they have the trust at the top level. Why would those people go anywhere else to buy the hardware? What that also facilitates is because that's happened, the customer is less beholden to the brand of the hardware. So then they don't say, oh, it has to be a Panasonic because that's a good brand. So my client can now actually do white label products, which cost them less. So that whole chain means that their profits have just gone through the roof, and that happened in about an 18-month period. So what we're seeing is no matter what industry you're in fact, the trip to Germany, they sell stuff. Largely, the challenge that we're putting to them is they need to change to be more of a consulting model that facilitates people buying the stuff at a higher margin. But if they remain a seller of stuff, yeah, sports manufacturer, one of the largest sports manufacturers started this journey, to be fair, about 8 years ago globally in their business to business. And it reaped huge dividends while they stuck to it. So the returns are massive. But there's also all the other stuff that, you know, that people say it's touchy-feely. Guess what? Your staff motivation goes up. You know, one of the other changes we're starting to see is in most organizations, except the, you know, that probably the pure sales organizations, if you take a law firm, for example, the history has been you come in as a graduate, you get stuck in a box, you learn technical stuff, you become the lackey for years and years and years. And then at some point you become a senior associate, and then you become a partner, and then they say, good luck, go and talk to some clients now. It's but that's nuts. So what we're starting to see in Australia finally is organisations, be they lawyers or engineers or whoever, saying, actually, we've only got 40 partners, we've got 400 juniors, why don't we send 400 people into the market, not just 40? So let's train these new graduates in the skills, let's reward the new graduate in their first week with a bonus for bringing work to the business, and let's train them to do it. The graduates love it because it's doing something different. So again, if you've got two law firms, and this is a really good example in a different city, not Sydney. Two law firms, one is doing that from graduate, and they're measurable on profitability, not just on timesheets. And you've got another law firm who are only letting their partners near clients, and all their measures are input measures through timesheets. Which one's going to grow fastest?
And which one's going to become the employer of choice is awesome.
Absolutely. So, you know, you look at the kids at university. My son's at university at the moment doing engineering business, and they know exactly what all the employers in town are doing. He comes to me and says, this doesn't look like a firm I want to work for, Dad. Mm. No, you're right, son. That word gets out pretty sharpish.
Yeah, it does. We were talking off air about the difference. We were talking about modern sales, and we were both sharing our experience that most sales techniques in the year 2016 are actually rebadged products from the 1970s and 80s, and they're not even rebadged all that well.
Yeah.
I think your point is that it's a different market, it's a different world, and it makes different demands, and that being the same, it won't cut it anymore.
Absolutely. And I'm very conscious, I don't want to be self-promoting here. So if there is anyone out there who's thinking...
It's okay, I will promote you, no problem.
Well, okay, I won't then. If there is anyone out there thinking that they might need to revisit their structure, their strategy, their sales strategy, the sales skills, what have you, I'm very happy to give third-party counsel, go and do your research. I don't want to be spruiking what I do in terms of the sales skills stuff, but be very, very clear. Are you looking to change your sales strategy? Do you want people to do better planning, which will get them to the customer's door?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want them to improve their skills, which is what they do once they get in the door?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or is it both? Be very clear, they're fundamentally different things. And then when you've got that, and let's say it's the strategy piece you want, what is it within that strategy piece you want them to be actually doing? When it's the skills piece, you then have to take a step back and think, okay, so what do we want our customers and clients to be thinking about us? And once you've really identified that and then go to the market, do two or three pilots, force the providers to do the pilots so you see, that isn't what we want, that is. Make sure you get what you really want, not what someone sells you. And you're right, sadly, there are still some very 70s and 80s sales approaches out there who are very successful at selling it into somebody who wants a risk-averse solution because it's a big brand, and they get no result. Make damn sure you don't waste this money. This is a critical decision in your, at a risk of getting in trouble here. Do not leave the decision to your HR function. No, seriously, this is a business imperative decision. Unless you genuinely have someone in your HR function who sits on the leadership team and understands your vision and understands the strategy to get there, this has to be a leadership team decision. And they have to be the ones involved in the process. There are some firms, I spoke to one the other day, who absolutely have the right person at the head of their BD team who sits on the leadership team and understands the strategy and is absolutely focused on it. Sadly, that is not the norm in most organizations. The BD or marketing report to someone else who sits on the leadership team, and you can't have that gap.
Okay, if you were to leave our listeners with one takeaway, what might that be?
The one takeaway from listening to this podcast, you know, that thought that you have where you wake up at 3 a.m. in a slightly cold sweat, revisit that thought in the morning when you wake up and really, really challenge your current paradigm. Get people in who you may not even like, maybe very different to you, come from a different world, seek their counsel, and then make a decision on whether you want to make a change. But if you decide not to change without seeking really harsh counsel, you're probably making a bad decision.
And the change that we're talking about is to shift from being a skills or expertise-based approach to being one that focuses on engineering trust in the other person.
Absolutely right. That's the ultimate aim, is how do you get to the point where your market, whatever your market is, totally trusts everyone in your organization? It's a good line to close on. What would it mean, anyone listening to this who is a senior person or owns an organization, what impact would it have on your organization if your sales team was not just your people, but was everyone in your market who ever met anyone in your firm? Think about that. Think about what impact would it have on your business if everyone that anyone in your firm ever spoke to trusted them so much that they were prepared to put their own careers on the line and on-sell your people. That's the high ground.
That's pretty powerful stuff.
Makes a big difference.
We're going to close on that high note. You've been listening to the Business Podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. Our guest today has been Keith Dugdale, author of Smarter Selling, How to Grow Sales by Building Trust. And their business is, well, it's called The Business of Trust. You can find it online. We value your opinion. If you're listening to us through iTunes, you can easily hit the subscribe button, leave a review, make a comment. All of it, you're very appreciated. We want to know what you want to know. What are the topics, the people, the issues that are of interest to you? You can email us, podcast@amcham.com.au. In fact, you can listen to all the podcasts on the website, amcham.com.au. This is AmCham, bringing business to you. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Business Podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. This podcast is supported by VML. VML is a full-service digital marketing agency that can take you where you want to go. Everything we are is in everything we do. This is AmChamp, bringing business to you.